Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is Michael.
And this is Kevin.
And you are listening to another episode of Sound Sessions. I'm so stoked for this next interview.
Yeah, we're talking with Max Lerman, and he's a music therapist and a really, really smart guy. Mm-hmm. He knows all about this stuff and what's going on in our brains as we consume music.
Yeah, it was a really enthralling kind of interesting. I learned a lot, basically.
I know. It was like every other sentence he had, it was like, oh, I can build on that. And what else can I ask here? Yeah, he's a really interesting guy.
This was great. And if you want to, you know, reach out to us, we can be found at itunes.com/soundsessions. Make sure that you go on, and we can't thank you enough for listening. But if you listen, you know, make sure you rate and review and leave a comment. You can reach us at our email at soundsessionspod@gmail.com.
We're also on Twitter at soundseshpod.
Mm-hmm. Sound Sesh Pod. And seriously, just reach out to us. We'd be happy to, you know, communicate with you guys. We reach out to everybody who writes us. And sometimes, you know, we hand out some CDs and we give some stuff away. So there's that to look forward to as well.
All the swag.
All right. So without further ado, here is our interview with Max Lerman.
Hi, this is Max Lerman, hospice and palliative care music therapist at North Shore University Health System. And you are listening to Sound Sessions.
Listening to Sound Sessions, the All Things Music podcast, hopefully your go-to All Things Music podcast, and kind of under that umbrella of All Things Music falls, this next interview that I've actually been really eager to get my hands on. We're going to be speaking with Max Lerman. He's a hospice and palliative care music therapist for the North Shore University Health System. This concept, I don't think it's that new, but it's really intriguing to me, and I guess just to start it, we can get some background here. From Max. Max, can you give us kind of just a basic overview in a, I don't know, I'm not going to do a word limit on you, but just a basic overview of what exactly music therapy is?
Yeah, so music therapy basically is the individualized and clinically based use of musical interventions to help address different symptoms or needs. And some examples of, you know, goals that are common in music therapy include decreasing anxiety, alleviating depressive symptoms, decreasing pain perception, and many others that as well. And they're all based upon the patient's individual needs and their personality as well, and how they respond to music in addition as well. So.
Okay, so could you, like, I guess, give me like an example? So say somebody's coming in and they're suffering from anxiety, or, and I'm sure like PTSD has probably got to be a huge thing for music therapy. Like, what are some applications that you as a music therapist would do?
Yeah, so I go in and see the patient. I have an assessment process that occurs. I acquire their, you know, emotional history, cognitive history, physical history as well. If they have a musical background, I mean, it's definitely an additive component, but it's not necessary. It's not a requirement for them to have an ability or a musical proficiency to participate in music therapy sessions. But I go and assess them. And some different interventions that I will use commonly with patients, especially for hospice or palliative care, include guided imagery. So that would be the use of imagery or visualization through a narrative script, where it kind of induces a state of relaxation.
So is that like you? I mean, I play in a band and we're playing music, and we also have a projection screen going on with just goofy projections and whatever. Is that kind of a similar concept almost?
Yeah, I don't really use electronic projection screen. It would be more of a narrative script that I read to them.
Oh, okay.
Or a recorded script that they would be listening to on an auditory level. And then through listening to the script, it could be an imagery of a beach or a forest or a positive or fond memory in their mind. But the music acts as a way to relax the patients and induce them into a state where they decrease their muscle tension, you know, helps with their heart rate, helps with their breathing, helps with their blood pressure. It can have all these physiological benefits to the patient as they're just listening to me read the script as I have supportive music behind them. It could be recorded music, could be live music. Typically, I use live music because it just creates more opportunities for participation that are more positive.
Yeah. Hey, Max, what's going on? This is Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, so I find this really interesting. I mean, the fact that you say, I mean, even just the fact that you use live music instead of recorded music, you definitely get a different sort of sense when you're at a show as opposed to when you're just, you know, chilling in your basement with your friends listening to a record or something like that. You sent over this great diagram of the brain. What's that musical portion of the brain? Like, where does it hit the hardest when you're finding this with your patients?
Well, with the brain, it's very interesting. Both hemispheres are interacting on a cognitive level when processing music. And so when we listen to music in general, especially when we're perceiving a performer, someone is engaging in a musical act, we are visually seeing a movement, whether it's dancing or a guitarist playing, and we have, you know, preconceived notions or ideas based on our own musical history, but then also the emotions that may be associated with that guitarist playing a particular song, or when the patient, for example, when I'm in a hospital room or a house or a nursing home, there immediately is an association that can be triggered based upon certain musical and temporal elements of that song, whether it's the harmony, the tempo, the dynamics. So the frontal lobe is immediately perceiving and observing, you know, what is going on, you know, visually, and that creates this idea of, well, this is what I like in terms of rhythm and timbre and harmony and pitches, because they have a certain association when they look at that person and they generate an opinion. And then, you know, you have the middle of your brain, that's kind of your motor cortex. So that's how we generate, you know, rhythm and time. And then, you know, the back of your brain, that's kind of your visual cortex. So your brain is just, it's a multifactorial kind of process that the brain is engaging in when processing music. So it's both sides of the brain. So
interesting, because you know, you can really feel that. That's why I when I'm at a show, Kevin, tell me if I'm wrong here, but like when you're seeing a band play and all of a sudden they hit that hit song or the cover of the song that you've always loved, and it just lights up your head, and you can feel it all through your body.
Oh yeah, that's something I actually want to touch on a little bit here. But yeah, absolutely.
Which brings me to my next point: play the hits. That's all we ask. We have a doctor saying that you should just make sure, if you want to have your audience feel good, just focus on those hits and leave the new stuff to the new records.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that what's interesting is that when you are processing rhythm and a pulse and a beat, and you have a certain experience or memory or an event or a story associated with that song you don't necessarily have to know that song. There's just something maybe harmonically that triggers in your mind and in your brain a positive aspect within that song musically. That's actually part of the emotional center of your brain. They call it the hypothalamus. It's your emotional regulation center. It helps regulate your stress, but it also is associated with memories, and there's been research that has also been founded with Alzheimer's dementia patients. That area of the brain is still intact, because when you look at the brain of an individual with Alzheimer's, they're actually called beta amyloid plaques. They're just basically plaques that block the neuron. And so that's what causes the decline in their disease progression. But the research has been found that area of the brain is still intact, and that's why music has such a positive benefit. If you've read stories or witnessed videos of patients with Alzheimer's, you know, being exposed to music, because that part of the brain has not been damaged at all. So, yeah.
This is, oh my God. The more you talk, the more I'm like coming up with more questions, and it's like I'm really curious. Oh, well, I guess going back a little bit earlier, you were talking about recorded music or live music, watching the music. What about having these patients play music? Is that an application as well?
Oh yeah, most certainly. I mean, songwriting is a huge component in working with patients, whether it's you know, music and songwriting through instrumental improvisation, going through, if it's a group music therapy session, if it's a group instrumental ensemble where they're learning to play an instrument, they're learning how to do an arrangement, learning how to do a composition. If it's music and movement where they're playing different instruments, Some very common, you know, music therapy instruments that we use include, you know, whether it's a rain stick or a djembe or maraca or hand drums or pedal drums, kind of more auxiliary, you know, percussion instruments that are more tactile, you know, it creates that sensory stimulation. But also, you know, using electronic piano, having them, you know, maybe do a duet with the music therapist to help facilitate if, let's say, that patient is isolated, you know, on a hospital unit, you know, but the family comes to only visit, you know, once a month, but then they come to visit and then everyone's playing an instrument. So that creates socialization.
That's great.
You know, so that songwriting is a great therapeutic process to help patients understand what is going on with their disease, why it's affecting their personality, difficulty coping, why they're having difficulty coping, you know, with their disease. And the thing with music is most of the time, I think, a non-confrontational medium. You know, I kind of compare it and make it and it's analogous to, you know, for example, your dog. Your dog will give you unconditional love and positive regard and empathy. Because, you know, at the end of the day, if you had a stressful day, if you're angry or unhappy, that dog's going to love you regardless. The music isn't necessarily going to judge you or it's going to have an opinion on you. The music is there to create a sense of security and comfort. So, you know, the music is a medium for them to have self-expression when, you know, inside a hospital, those patients, they don't have autonomy because they have to have a nurse come in. They have to come a doctor.
Oh, man.
They have a doctor come in. And the music is just such a refresher for them. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I really think, like, there's a time and a place for almost all types of music, whether it be, like, I'm in the gym, I'm listening to metal, or, you know, I'm
right
out with friends and I'm listening to pop music, or I'm chilling out and I'm listening to instrumental.
Kevin, come on. We all know you're listening to Fergie.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's a time and a place.
That's what's going on.
No guilty pleasure. So, I mean, I guess my question is, does the type of music, is it uniform, or could you say, like, oh, well, this Slayer song would be great for this session, and then this Fergie? I mean, like, where are you picking your music, I guess, and does the genre play a role at all?
It's a multi-layered process. And it all comes around to the patient's preference of music, because in the end, if you are trying to pick songs that you think the patient will like, then you're not doing, as a music therapist, you're not doing your due diligence and research to individualize the music therapy interventions to their needs. And it's all about finding out the patient's blueprint, figuring out what are songs that have associations to certain memories, certain events, certain stories that connects to that patient on an interpersonal level. You know, the music acts as a blueprint to their biography, to their personality, in which, you know, those certain song selections can be a reflection of a person's traits or qualities about themselves. And you want to create an environment with the music that creates a sacred and intimate space, because that's the way that they are able to be most successful. And whether it is Slayer and whether it's Metallica or James Taylor or even Taylor Swift, you know, any kind of genre is open, whether or not that patient really enjoys it. And as a music therapist, it forces you to learn all kinds of repertoire, which is great. So it's definitely challenging for me in terms of self-growth, you know, in terms
super
of
cool
building my musical ability.
Yeah.
So it's really just, it all comes around to the patient. Because the minute you don't focus on the patient, then you're not doing your job, you know. So
that's right up, you know, my alley. I feel like I'm learning a lot through this interview already.
I feel like every other sentence you're saying is like a great quote or something. You know?
I know, because I feel the same way. And maybe this conversation, you know, could be saved for another day. But I think that you'd be a good guy to ask this. You know, music genres. You mentioned the fact that a lot of it ties to memories or good feelings that we had, and people, you know, from all different ages, races, and creeds listen to different types of music. Where do we get this genre? Does it purely come from our brain, or like this genre preference, I guess I'm asking about? Does it come from our brain, or is it just you know, just could I like finally tune a person to just really be into Taylor Swift for the rest of their life, or is it like innately in you, I guess I'm asking?
It's cultural influences and variables with that patient or individual or any person who enjoys music. You know, there was a study, a music therapist by the last name of Iwanaga from 1989, She found that excitative and sedative music, you know, in comparing different levels of timbre, rhythm, and harmony, and time and pace, and all the musical elements within a song differ based upon patient's musical preferences and musical types under, you know, conditions where the stimuli is controlled by an external source. So that was a study she did. And so, you know, she found that, you know, you have to be weary of choosing song selections based upon an individual's personality because, you know, certain triggers or behaviors may become manifested because while they may be conscientious of certain aspects of a certain genre that may be maladaptive for that person versus certain aspects about another type of genre of music that may elicit positive associations or behaviors. So it's really about that neurological connection that the patient has with the song. And it's definitely, you have to look at that patient's history and what music they've been really exposed to, you know, over time. And you know, recognizing those triggers, coping with those triggers when you're with the patient. And those don't have to be bad triggers. They can be good triggers too. But it's really about, you know, genre and preference over time, sentimentally, you know, with a person is grown over time just from exposure or being exposed by your parents or family or friends. You know, just hearing certain songs just creates certain associations, and those implant on your brain.
You know? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, are you finding with your patients that there's one specific genre of music that's working? Like, what would you ease somebody into this therapy with? Would it be straight, you know, I don't know, John Cougar Mellencamp? Are you finding maybe some
this
light?
This is a window into your brain right now, Michael.
Some Chuck Mangione, just easing them right into it with a little bit of horn. What do you find is working the best for a person who's just getting into this therapy process?
Well, you know, in the introductory steps with a patient, you know, typically if I don't know the genre, I just try to be conscientious of, you know, what are their age demographics, when did they grow up, when were they born. And so I try to pick certain song selections that, you know, have more of a neutral association or aspect to it with respect to you know, patients, whether they might have a proclivity towards that genre or not, that they don't necessarily would think is bad or good. But, you know, so certain classical composers, maybe like Bach or Mozart, I'll start off with, or I'll go completely improvisatory and initiate, maybe like for a patient for end of life, for example, I'll initiate a transient lullaby that's completely improvised just based on, you know, certain chord progressions that...
Is that you playing it for them?
What was that?
Is that you playing...
Yeah, that might be me playing it for them, because typically I won't go into a recorded song selection that's improvisatory or something that I'm just thinking up the top of my head that'll be like, well, that could work. I don't want to do that. You know, it may be, you know, certain chord progressions that have certain associations to trigger certain moods or events. I mean, for example, if you look in history, the idea of minor major tonalities in music, minor tonalities, if you look at research and studies, even going back to the time of the Greeks and the Romans, minor tonality was always associated with sadness or feeling unhappy, whereas, you know, major keys were always associated with energy and motivation and outgoingness
and DJ
the desire to want to do work. And so it's trying to find a happy medium. So, you know, if it's, for example, patient end of life, and I'm just kind of figuring out what could be a supportive level of music just to help them with, you know, breathing and there's no family present, but clearly I don't know what genre they like. I'll just from my music therapy knowledge, I'll initiate a chord progression that I know that, you know, might be a 1-6, 2-5, or, you know, or harmonically kind of matches where their body is and kind of matches them in terms of entrainment, in terms of physical responses, and then see where I'll go from there. And then after the session is over, I mean, I call the family right away, and I usually ask about their, you know, musical history. You know, because sometimes you don't always have the opportunity to, you know, have the family if they're there.
Sure.
So you got to just jump in, you know.
Right,
just start a session and just see what happens. So it's really just kind of going with the flow and going in the moment. You know, a big part of what I do in hospice is just kind of assessing the room, assessing the dynamics, assessing the person, you know, right in the moment. You just have to gather information
yeah.
and then just figure out musically what kind of complements who they are. And you don't know all that information right away, but you, based on your musical abilities and just right away doing a little history beforehand, before going right. in to do that assessment, then you figure out, well, this could be a song selection that could work, or an improvisatory chord pattern that could work when I play on the guitar. So
yeah, this sounds like a really gratifying field to be doing, you know, working. How often do you find yourself saying, like, or how, I guess, how often do you have those I love my job moments?
Mm-hmm. Oh, every day. I mean, because honestly, I'm the least invasive of the disciplines that come right. in to usually work with the families and the patients. I mean, we have chaplain and the social work, and they provide emotional support and help with advanced directives or putting placement of patients into nursing facilities or financial assistance and funding, but I'm in there helping the family and the patient participate in music therapy interventions, whether that's reminiscing or doing a song legacy project where I record me and the patient singing, you know, via recorded iPad, and then make it into a CD for the family to have as a memento or memory when mm-hmm. they die, or if it's past the music listening. But it's sacred space, you know. It's
yeah.
it's you know, people in America, and I think throughout the world, I feel, have this stigma. They've created this perception in the general populace that hospice is a death wish. And, you know, really the focus on hospice and palliative care is focusing on quality of life. How can we provide that space, that healing space, so that death can be a peaceful transition, and that it can be done with comfort and dignity, upholding the patient's spiritual well-being and emotional health, and, you know, making sure that that environment allows that patient to explore issues through music on a physical, social and cognitive and emotional level. You know, it's really taking that vulnerability and making it a safe haven, so that, you know, the patient can process their own grief, their own denial, their own sadness, their own loss of self-esteem, or whatever issues they may be going through, their pain. You know, music's a universal language everyone
right.
speaks.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing, you know, the research and studies have shown hearing is the last sense to still remain intact, you know, neurologically with a person, you know, when they decline.
Man,
and
yeah.
it's a non-pharmacological approach. Music is not an invasive medium. I mean, you have to be wary of what songs you're picking, but music is supposed to create a feeling of safety
yeah.
and comfort. When we go to a concert and we listen to music, or you listen to your favorite song when you're running or doing exercise,
mm-hmm.
you're in that world of that song in that moment, you know, because you know subconsciously how that music is affecting you, because it drives you, or it motivates you, or it makes you cry. That's the beauty of music, you know, it's universally working on the brain,
yeah.
you know, to trigger whatever behavior you're going through in that moment.
It's undeniable, you know, the effect that music has, and I doubt that anybody would put that to the test, because you can feel how good music makes you feel. It's,
mm-hmm.
I mean, and speaking on that, like, the work that you do with these patients and everything who are going through so much. I mean, these nurses and doctors with needles and medicine all day, and then here comes Max with the djembe rolling
they
through the door.
They have to, like, be happy to see him, yeah.
You gotta be the most popular guy at that place.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the time I definitely am viewed, and I have a label placed upon me as someone who definitely brings positive spiritual, emotional, and physical healing through music.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to be conscientious and wary and advocate for my profession, because there are times where people do have misperceptions or miscalculations or misviews or views that are not necessarily correct all the time as to what they think that I do. And so a lot of times they see me with a guitar on my back and various instruments, and so they assume that, you know, I can play for a certain number of patients, or if I'm in a nursing home, a healthcare discipline who works there may look at me and say, well, you know, who are you playing for? What concert are you doing today? And that's when I have to give my, you know, I call it, you know, elevator moment
right.
or, of information, where I talk to them about, you know, how music therapy works, what does it do, what are the benefits, you know, and then the education that a music therapist actually goes through.
Oh, yeah.
Because people have this perception that music is only associated with celebrities or entertainers in a lobby, or a high school student playing recreationally in the hallway of a building, of a business or company, you know, or, you know, whatever views that they've conceived in their mind as to what a music therapist is. And even you can even look on various, you know, websites for even job postings, like LinkedIn, for example, and they'll put a label on a posting where it says a music therapy volunteer. And that's completely the opposite of what music therapy actually is. It's not a volunteer position. There are over 5,000 music therapists in the U.S. that work in various different settings. Yeah. Well, and,
talk about that. I mean, you're mentioning your education, and I can kind of see it's a massive list of courses and everything you have to go through. But I guess before all that, what made you want to get into this field?
Well, it was actually a personalized experience with observing my grandmother, who was on hospice, and witnessing a music therapist help her during the end of life process and situation, and where I just felt sentimentally it just seemed like the right path. I don't know if it was divine providence or divinity or some kind of message subconsciously that came down for me from a higher deity or whatnot. I know, as cliched as that may sound, but it just seemed like the right field and profession to go into for me, because I knew of my musical skills and abilities, and I just wanted to put it to use in helping people, in healing people, and allowing people to allow themselves to process their disease progression through the use of music. And it just seemed like the right pathway, and it allowed me to be successful when I, you know, got my bachelor's degree at Iowa, you know, in music therapy, and I said, this just seems like the right curriculum. It worked for me.
Sounds like you're in the right field for sure. I mean, you know your stuff. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, it was just really a complimentary fit, you know. And then it was interesting though, because I was toying with different degrees academically when I first started in music, in trying to decide whether I wanted to do music therapy or another area. It's every struggle every college student I know goes through.
Yep.
But I wanted to be actually a speech therapist, because I thought, you know, language and music, obviously they're complementary, you know.
Yeah.
But it turned out I really had a disdain towards speech therapy. It didn't fit my strengths and who I was and my personality. And you know, it worked out great for me, you know.
Yeah.
And I love the coursework for music therapy. It's you have psychology, you do a little bit of humanities. You know, I still had to have all my performance ensembles, and then you had different classes that focused on different populations in music therapy, whether it was Alzheimer's, dementia, mental illness, children with intellectual developmental disabilities, that's like autism or cerebral palsy. So you get to train in all these different sites, you know, that are around Iowa City. And it was great. It was, you know, it was just like practicum, like for a nurse, and you hone your skills, you know, and techniques and approaches and as to how to lead sessions and develop care plans. And it's really fulfilling.
Yeah. You know, that's so, so interesting and so great. You know, a little aspect of my life, I was going to school to become a special education teacher with behavior disorder students. And when we would be in the classroom setting, the kids, you know, they can't really keep their attention on one specific thing. So they'd be, you know, all over the place. But then when the music teacher came in, like at least once or twice a week, it would just be total focus. And he would just bring everybody
cool
like a drum.
That?
And it just, it was like, it was, everyone was lasered on getting the right kind of beat. Everyone was silent.
Yeah.
It's really cool how you can just hone your mind and you know, train it to do these certain things.
And to build on that, I don't know if there's any research or anything to support this, but like you look across every culture throughout the history of the world. I mean, music has been there, you know, forever. I feel like humans are meant to make music, you know?
Exactly, and they use it as communication. Like, think about the early tribes who would use it to communicate with each other across the river, you know, just like with the pounding of the drums and everything. It's so interesting.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, I think culturally, different populations across the world of people of different creeds, beliefs, sexual orientation, and people of different ethnicities have different musical traditions that affect, you know, various rituals or philosophies that they have towards For example, hunting or coming into the house or marriage or a rite of passage in growing older with respect to maturity. The youngest one of a tribe, for example, maybe in Africa, has to move up and gain respect to the elders. There's different musical traditions and musical pieces that are specific to their culture and belief and values that allow that youngest one to move up into adulthood, or different musical traditions associated with marriage and different cleansing rituals from different tribes in Africa, and even cultures and societies in Europe, different musical traditions about Christmas. So there's different associations for different cultures everywhere across the world and how people view music and adapt music to ways in which there's cultural diversity that's, individualized for their culture. And it's really an onus on us, as a society. I mean, when we look at, people across America or all parts of the world to understand other people's musical traditions, because that allows us to gain insight and knowledge into their world and their personalities and how they live in their societies. So.
Think about how important it was. I mean, just in recent news events with the presidential candidate, and how important it was his music choices were.
Right.
Like, people, that was a hot news story for about 2 weeks. Like, who was he going to have perform? And, like, how good or bad they were. And, like, people were judging
it. Was it a cover band? Oh, wait, no, they couldn't play.
The cover band. The Bruce Springsteen cover band actually sounded kind of good. But it's so true, because think about a wedding without music. I mean,
so many things, yeah.
It's so intriguing.
Now, Max, I want to, real quick here, just as an aside, how you doing on time? Because we keep going off on tangents here, and I'm really enjoying this conversation. Are you okay on time still?
Yeah. I mean, however much longer you want to go.
All right, well, cool. I mean, you kind of mentioned earlier some misviews of the field, and then actually talking just now, Michael, about politics and things like that. Does, like you said, the field is sometimes misunderstood or maybe not respected, unfortunately. Does the field have, like, full government support, or is there any danger of anything like that?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to clarify. It's not that we don't have respect. There is absolutely respect for music therapists in various settings and facilities. I guess the point I was trying to make really is more about advocacy and the idea that there is most certainly headway legislatively in various states to make music therapy a licensed profession. And good. So in Illinois, currently in Springfield on the Hill, there is legislation created for an advisory board, which I believe is comprised of speech therapists, there's a social worker, 2 or 3 music therapists, a doctor. And so the goal of the advisory board is to analyze the pros and cons of music therapy, within the state of Illinois, and the benefits of it being a licensed profession, with respect to protections and liabilities and measures to make sure that music therapy can be a protected field. I mean, currently, right now, music therapy, you get a board certification, and so the board certification is completed after you complete a 1,200-hour clinical internship, and so that's at an approved a facility. And that's overseen. Your internship is overseen by a board certified music therapist. And I wanted to preface and add that the professional organizations for music therapy, there's two bodies. There's the American Music Therapy Association, which pretty much every music therapist in the U.S. is mostly a member. You don't have to be a member, but it's definitely a supportive organization that helps with research and education and credentials as well. And then there's the regulatory body that music therapists are regulated by, known as the Certification Board of Music Therapists, and they oversee credentials, policies, education, research protocols, to add a few for the music therapy profession. And so, once you complete your internship, which is comprised of, doing sessions and documentation, leading in services, honing your music therapy skills, instrument skills, you take your board certification exam. And so then once you're board certified and pass the exam, over a 5-year period, you have to collect 100 continue education, you know, credits. And so those are kind of the protocols, you know, in place to be a music therapist. Clearly, you have to have your bachelor's degree. Some states are working towards a master's degree.
Oh, wow.
For music therapy. So really, it's about education and knowledge and services in the community, making people have the awareness of what music therapy is, and just explaining the differences to people of how music therapy works versus, you know, an entertainer or celebrity or high school student recreationally playing music.
Right.
Or, you know, it's just really, you know, explaining the difference. And the states, there are various states that actually do have music therapy licensed. Some of those include North Dakota, Georgia, I believe Nevada. I think Utah is working towards licensure. Texas is working towards licensure. So okay. It's definitely gaining ground. People are definitely recognizing the benefits of music therapy and the settings that it can really be provided in to help all kinds of different populations. So.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when I was at South by Southwest, a big push to fund and to, I guess, legitimize the art of music therapy was being pushed there. Lots of places were doing that. You know, you mentioned the reasons for music therapy was, you know, the increasing self-expression, enhancement of spirituality, reducing anxiety, improving coping skills. I wondered if you'd be able to give our listeners any relaxation techniques or anything that you can, you know, kind of go through with the day, because I'm sure you give, you know, people that you're working with a little bit of something to take away for daily use.
Yeah, most certainly. So, you know, one music intervention that everybody can do as a form of wellness, not that they would be able to have a music therapist accompany them by their side, is guided imagery. And this is something anyone can do on their own individually. You know, you don't necessarily have to have a music therapist, but a lot of times with patients in the hospital, I give them resources, strategies. I give them an education and I teach them how to do guided imagery on their own. And so guided imagery is an intervention that anyone individually can do on a leisurely basis to help, you know, themselves relax. And so, you know, typically just some tips and strategies to start up a guided imagery. You want to have a pretty lowly, dimly lit room. You don't want any, you know, bright lighting, because typically that is distracting to the pupils and they'll dilate more, and that doesn't really lead to a conducive state of relaxation in terms of, you know, your overall body. You want to make sure that the tempo, typically, of the music, you know, 60 to 70, you know, beats per minute. Not that everyone necessarily has to have a metronome, but most certainly there are some preferred song selections, or there could be certain songs that could lead to a further enhanced state of relaxation. And, you know, some examples of some different musical selections for wellness could be Prelude to an Afternoon of a Faun. You know, that's Debussy. Nocturne number 1 in B flat minor, that's Chopin. You know, those are just
classic.
Some examples of, you know, classical pieces. But, you know, ultimately it should be music that, you know, that you as the patient, or you as yourself, not to label them, that person as a patient, has a preference towards. There's various Gregorian chants that you could utilize that could help induce relaxation. And so the reason those song selections work is because aspects of the timbre, the rhythm, the melody, the harmony, the dynamics, those are more neutral. And that they don't create an excitatory state. You know, you don't want to have an excitatory state when you're trying to go through guided imagery. Once you find the song selection that works for you, it's just finding a position that's comfortable for you. So it could be a chair, it could be your bed, it could be your couch. You could be lying down, you could be sitting up in your chair in a comfortable position, and then have that recorded music going on in the background, you know, and then focusing on your breathing, you know, making sure that you're having mindfulness towards the breathing in and out, you know, and mindfulness definitely plays a factor into creating a conducive state of relaxation. You know, there could be thoughts of restlessness or anxiousness or pain or discomfort or frustration or depressive symptoms that may be on your mind, or thoughts or feelings. But the idea is that the music acts as a supportive component to help, you know, carry those thoughts, you know, away through the narrative that you hear in the background. It could be a beach. It could be a positive memory. It could be your favorite trip. It could be your wedding. It could be your bar mitzvah. It could be a forest. You know, and there are lots of scripts out there. You know, with my patients, I usually, you know, I make a copy of the scripts that, you know, work for them.
Yeah.
But there are definitely some resources online that you could find of different guided imagery, you know, scripts, and you could have someone read it to you. Typically, it's always good to have someone, you know, read it to you. You know, if it's a family member, you know, they could be reading it to you while the recording goes on. And you know, with relaxation, there's different techniques. A technique that I use a lot is progressive muscle relaxation. So it's different. It's isolating different muscle groups from your lower extremities to your upper extremities. And you know that squeeze release from your toes to your feet to your legs.
I know that one.
To your shoulders. Yeah. So that's a very common intervention I use with guided imagery at times to help relaxation. But in the end, it's really about channeling your focus back to the breathing, because if the breathing creates the state of homeostasis for your whole body, because it always has to channel back, you know, to your breathing, ultimately. Because if it doesn't go back to your breathing, then the guided imagery is not as successful.
And you know, it's funny too. I'm looking through your notes here about some uses here. You have music and mandala making, and that's actually organically stumbled upon that myself. Just, you know, listen to music, doodle on a sketch pad for a bit, and making mandalas. And
what's a mandala?
So I don't know if you want to get into it a little bit more, Max, but for me, it's you've seen them everywhere. It's a geograph or a geological image.
Is this the four-sided cube that you make?
Well, it's so you can usually in terms of when I use music in an arts and crafts medium. The idea with the mandala is easy because it utilizes the concept of a circle, and you can have the circle as just like a pre-drawn template that you can make copies of, you know. And so the circle, if you look at historically and culturally from different traditions and societies, the idea of harmony going back from the Native Americans to Buddhist traditions, the idea that life revolves around in a circle, that everything creates a sense of unity when you are able to focus on the idea that life revolves around in a circle, in terms of maintaining your own spirituality, perspective, insight, ideas of love and happiness and anger. I mean, you look at Buddhist traditions of karma, you know, and the idea of, you know, reincarnation. It all goes back to the philosophy of the circle.
Right.
And so the idea of music and mandala making that's so beneficial is that it allows patients and even individuals that want to do it on their own just for wellness, that you are able to engage in self-expression, creativity, a sense of fluidity, and enhance your self-expression and enhance your self-esteem and feelings through the use of, it could be paint, colored pencils, crayons, whatever colored medium you want to use. It doesn't even have to be color. It could be just pencil. You know, any form of design through supportive or recorded music that, mm-hmm. that you create freehand, or you can make it structured, it helps a person process their anxiety because they have their interpretation of that design relative to what they felt the music was dictating to them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be the music dictating that person, but it's the idea that consciously or subconsciously the music creates a pattern or a medium or a gateway for that person to open up their feelings in a manner in which creates more logic, maybe a perspective for that patient, or gives them a sense of how free flowed in nature they could be in terms of their personality. And if they're feeling stressed, then you know, the mandala can help them, you know, just process, you know, why they're having stress. How did they become stressful? Like, and then you analyze the pattern and you analyze the colors, why they chose colors.
Oh, that's interesting.
Why they made certain lines, why they made certain shapes, why they went in a certain direction.
Huh.
And then you ask them whether or not the music dictated that or it didn't dictate, and you process with that person. You it's great to do in groups, just because, you know, then everybody has a discussion as to why they engaged in a particular design.
Yeah, that's like a whole other conversation. That's very interesting.
You know, for me, there's nothing more meditative than just putting on some Coltrane and doing a well-crafted rhombus.
Okay. So I kind of wanted to get into it with you also. Well, a couple things here. Like, for example, whenever October rolls around, and I don't know, Max, if you're familiar with this band, but Michael, I figure you are. Mm-hmm. This band AFI, whenever October rolls around, there's just something so October about AFI to me, or vice versa. You know what I mean?
I can see that.
So I have to listen to AFI come October. So that kind of, to me, like, it triggers memories from high school coming up and listening to this band. So what is it about, I guess, music or songs that can kind of trigger memories and trigger, like, why do I come October want to listen to AFI? Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, I mean, In answering your question, you talk about this idea of frisson or music of memories that, you know, you, from a young age, from when we grow up and through our whole life cycle and journey through life, you know, certain music or certain song selections have associations to memories because that song resonated prominently during that time of that event, you know, or there may be an association, whether it's negative or positive, that affects our internal organs, our well-being, our personality, or it's a part of our blueprint to who we are because there was a certain event or a story that just connected with that song at an interpersonal level.
Yeah.
You know, and music can definitely unearth repressed feelings deep down from inside a person's subconscious because those feelings were just a part of that journey. And sometimes they become unearthed when you're in the moment of doing something or a certain circumstance where that song may be on. And, you know, for example, you know, certain songs trigger memories of my grandmother, for example,
right.
You know, when she passed away, you know, during the memorial service after she died, you know, I did a version of Tupelo Honey by Van Morrison. And so every time I hear that song, you know, it just brings back, you know, memories of, you know, going to Florida and Siesta Key with her and memories of visiting her at the nursing home facility and, or just memories of going out to dinner with her at a restaurant.
Sure.
Or it just triggers. Just it's like a multi-layered trigger that just all of a sudden becomes unearthed of just all the memories that I had with her. And so, you know, and this can even be seen or felt during different times of the season, like you said, with the fall or the winter. I mean, when we hear, you know, a Christmas carol, that immediately makes you think of the snow.
Right.
Yeah.
Or cocoa or, you know, the pine trees or, you know, being together for Christmas dinner with your family for the holidays, just because maybe that song was sung in the past when you were a child or when throughout the years as you got older, you know, that was a tradition that was kept up. You know, music and tradition, they've always been tied together. You know, music has always been a ritualistic landmark within our minds, you know, whenever we go through certain major milestones in our life in which music all of a sudden becomes triggered because, you know, it was something that happened with the family or friends where maybe you sang a particular song or a song was on during a particular moment that something significant or major happened. And when that happens, you know, that song becomes imprinted with that event because it was such a significant event in your mind, it immediately gets stored into your long-term memory. And so once that's in your long-term memory, that song is also latched on to that memory as well. It doesn't go away. And I mean, there's lots of, you know, science and research, you know, regarding, you know, music and memories. I mean, you can even go to the late Oliver Sacks, you know, and his work and how he focused on, you know, music and memory, and just how all of those music and memories attached to our personalities, attached to our well-being and who we are. It's part of our life cycle. Music is part of our life cycle, yeah. Especially if it's, you know, attached to a significant experience, you know, and you're going to remember that experience forever, you know, and that song.
Mm-hmm. So what about too, like, there's been moments where I've not heard the song before, but there's something about like the exact right moment, or maybe a line from a song hits you, and you know, you touched on the frisson, which is the chills that you can get, from music. How does that happen? I mean, like, I've gotten it to the point where I almost, like, break down in tears, you know? We got the chills so much from something.
Has that ever happened to you, Kevin?
Oh, it happens all the time.
You know,
I love it.
I have a specific anecdote about that. When I was working, before I got into radio, I was working at a bank. And every day I toiled away at this bank. I mean, it was just pressing buttons and doing paperwork all day. I felt tortured. And then I remember specifically, like, there was a time I was riding the bus to work, and I was listening to this Format song. Nate Roos, who is in the band Fun, it's his band before that, and he had this song. It was called The Gambler, and it came on. Never heard it before, but there was this one thing that said, you know, if life is just a gamble, you want to gamble if you want to win. And then all of a sudden, I listened to that song every single day for a month and ended up quitting my job because of that song.
Yeah,
because it was like invoking this, like,
right.
This, like, push towards me. So it was really...
That's remarkable. See, and the same thing. It's like, I have a specific example too. Briefly.
Yeah.
Sorry, Max, to keep running on here, but I was going for a run and I was wrapping up my run and I was really struggling. And then there was this song by this band, Phoenix. I don't even know if they're around anymore.
Oh, yeah, I remember Phoenix.
Oh, yeah, they're around. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Regardless of the band, but anyway, it was a heavier band. But as I'm finishing up my run, I'm really struggling, and then they had this like building up moment in the song, and it just like I got the chills so hard it pushed me to like push through the rest of the run, and I just felt like totally impacted by it. That's to me like the power of music. What is that? Like how can music impact our brains and our bodies in such a way?
Well, in terms of the brain and the body, it actually goes back to the autonomic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system is the regulatory process. Or the regulatory processes, rather, within your nervous system that affect your functioning and state of your internal organs. You know, your sex drive, pain, pleasure centers, your respiratory rate, heart rate, blood pressure. And so, you know, we talk about our nervous system being divided into sympathetic and parasympathetic. So we have the idea of, you've heard of the theory, fight or flight, you know, with stress versus calm versus a calm state. So, you know, your nervous system is constantly switching back and forth based upon certain situations, and music has that same effect. And so music, what happens is certain musical or tempo elements within a certain song can shift your body in different directions and vector your body in different directions, you know, increase your heart rate, you know, affect your vascular constriction, you know, create certain goosebumps on your skin, make you cry, make you smile, make you want to push yourself.
Yep.
Because when you think about our brain goes through this idea of entrainment, and it's also a neurological music therapy technique called rhythmic auditory stimulation. So the idea of being able to neurologically connect with a rhythm or beat based upon our internal systems or perceptions of the environment, and then how the music is affecting us to move or navigate through that environment. So when you talk about running, the idea of when you're running and you're hearing a song, your brain automatically entrains to a pulse, because in your motor cortex and your brainstem, when you're talking about your heart, your lungs, your feet, your legs, your joints, they're all moving to a rhythm, because, right, you know, your brain, your brainstem, and your motor cortex is telling you, okay, you know, you're going at 80 beats per minute or 90 beats per minute or whatever beat that your brain is going to. And so then when you hear a song that's analogous to maybe that similar heart rate, then your brain automatically just attunes to that, you know, pulse. You know, our brains are our own metronome, you know. And so that our brain then, you know, affects, you know, like what I was talking about earlier, the hypothalamus, you know, that's your emotional center. And that's why you would get, you know, chills or goosebumps on your skin or start crying or, you know, make yourself angry when you hear a certain song, because your brain is saying, oh, you know, I got to activate certain cortical centers, you know, within the middle of the brain.
That's so interesting.
And then it tells your emotional center of your brain, okay, this is an associative feeling, you know, with that song. And, you know, this idea of rhythmic auditory stimulation or entrainment of rhythm to music, I use it quite often with patients with Parkinson's. So when you talk about a Parkinson's patient, they have a symptom called bradykinesia, which is where they have freezing or unsteady gait, where they're unable to recognize where to place their feet because in their brain has basically told them, you know, stop. Okay. You know, the brain is like, I'm unsure where to put the foot, you know? And so, and then when you take a song that's familiar, to that patient, then all of a sudden, you know, you get them to entrain to that that pulse or that beat. And then all of a sudden the music acts as a form of physical therapy in and of itself. Cause then the music just basically, since it's a familiar song, then it's like the motor cortex of the brain tells your emotional center of your brain, your hypothalamus, oh, wait, I love that song. It's a great memory that I had with that song. And so then that Parkinson's patient, all of a sudden, the music acts as an impetus or a facilitator to help them, you know, move their foot, and then they're able to evenly place one foot after another or whatever your goals are that you're working on with that person. That's just an extended example, but that's the physical trigger, you know, of music for a patient that has a deficit, you know, due to their disease, you know, progression, such as Parkinson's. But your brain is automatically connecting, you know, when you hear a song. It's like the neuronal connection. Boom. It's like boom, 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 boom. And then that's why you have a certain feeling or a physical response with music.
This is so, like, also, that was terribly interesting to me. And it's kind of funny, like, to me also, the fact that, you know, I'm talking about this, like, oh, you know, I was going through this moment, blah, blah, blah. And then we get to Max, and he's like, oh, well, that's just your brain doing this and this and this. It's like, oh.
Yeah. It's your brain's on a metronome, and it's just working like this. The hypothalamus.
Yeah. But Max, this is all really great stuff. We won't keep you much longer here. I know we've had you for about an hour now, which is insane.
No problem.
But I want to know, what are you listening to for enjoyment?
I have a lot of different varieties of music that I enjoy that, you know, it's, you know, reflective of my eclectic and I feel complex personality. It's interesting that the way I process music is just is can occur at such a rapid pace. I have my whole life I've actually had ADHD.
Oh.
And so the way that I process music is not only through associations and memories, but if I'm in a certain mood or if I'm moving or if, you know, I'm thinking about certain events or situations, or if I, for example, just played tennis, music just automatically connects to that moment, kind of just on an interpersonal level, or if I just played a show, or if I'm playing a show, I'm in a band outside of also what I do.
Cool.
As a music therapist. But
what's your band called?
We're called Groove Witness. Yeah, we're R&B rock.
Nice.
Jazz, kind of jazz fusion, you know, group. It's all original music. We, you know, play at different clubs.
Very cool.
Around the city. Posthumously the Double Door. I'm trying to think.
I know.
Yeah, Goose Island, Wrigleyville, and they're gone too.
Great.
But, you know, different, you know, clubs and restaurants.
Just imagine how awesome it would be listening to that band. He's got all the right moves. You probably feel so great about the time you left.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, in terms of, you know, music that I'm enjoying now, I, you know, recently been reminiscing a little bit about some older 90s bands like Imogen Heap. And then I'm trying to think, you know, I'll even regress and enjoy some Third Eye Blind or the Beatles.
You just struck a chord. Kevin's hypothalamus just lit up to a 10th degree.
I love Third Eye Blind. We talked to Chris Reed of the their guitar player this summer, and I've, like, for whatever reason, that band just always seems to pop up in some way or another in this podcast, and yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Yep. And I'm trying to think what else. I recently have been on a techno electronica beat because I just started a Soul Cycle class.
Mm. Oh, cool.
They do, like, some Martin Garrix and, you know, BB Rexha, you know. Mm. So, like, I've been listening to people like that. So, my genres that I listen to are definitely associated to different moods and temperaments that I'm in, you know. So, it's just really interesting how, you know, my mind just kind of jumps to certain songs in my mind. You know, like, the other couple weeks ago, I was listening to the band, and they have one of their concerts that Martin Scorsese filmed called The Last Waltz. And so Van Morrison did a song called Caravan, and I was listening to that
nice.
A couple weeks ago. So I jump around, and it's just like spontaneously when my body's feeling a certain way, it's like autonomic. I know what music I want to listen to.
Right.
I don't know how it works. I think a lot of it is subconscious, but yeah, so there's definitely a large variety of musical genres.
Right. Well, I think there's a time and a place for almost any genre, you know. There's
yeah.
But yeah, it speaks to the moods. But yeah, Max, again, we'll wrap it up here. I think we really appreciate your last hour here. It's been I feel like we could talk to you all day about this too.
Yeah,
like I said,
absolutely.
The more you go on, the more I think of stuff. But yeah, we'll wrap it up. Thank you so much for your time, Max. He is Max Lerman. He's a hospice and palliative care music therapist for the North Shore University Health System. You can go to northshore.org. And Max, one more time, your band name and where can people find more on that?
Groove Witness. You can find us on Facebook. We are known as Groove Witness, jazz, R&B, fusion funk band. Our album is called Wandering Soul.
Cool.
You can find it on iTunes, I think Amazon, CD Baby. And our website, you can find us at groovewitness.us, and it has you know, our upcoming shows and just our bio and links and general information about us. We do have a couple shows coming up, or I think actually one show coming up in May, I believe. We are going to be playing at the Honky Tonk Barbecue in Pilsen.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, it's a 3-hour show. We'll be there from 10:30 to about 1 in the morning. So, yeah, it's you know, definitely an intimate place if people want to come out and enjoy some barbecue and listen to some music and no cover. And we'd love to have some people out of people
right on,
come enjoy us. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Max.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank Kevin and Michael. Thank you for your time.
Can't get enough of Sound Sessions? Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter @SoundSeshPod, and check us out on Instagram @SoundSessionsWGN.